The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start with the cover story headline, Now What? North Carolina grapples with road funding solutions as a host of issues such as electric vehicles, fuel-efficient cars, and autonomous vehicles are slowing down North Carolina's gas tax revenue. And the story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, The Unworkable Math of Gas Tax, written by Lauren Onasorge. From where he sits, running the Kenley 95 truck stop in Johnston County, longtime general manager Ernie Brame sees a lot of passing freightliners. Business is good, he says, better than it has been. But that's now. The aging highway is one of the East Coast's main logistics corridors, with long-haul trucks moving wares between locales such as Florida and New York, right past the truck stop and its iconic lighthouse sign. But that's today. When you're a truck, you can avoid a state where the taxes are higher, Brame says, and that means avoiding the truck stops along the way. Kenley 95 is one of the largest truck stops along the East Coast, with about 18,000 square feet of retail space and a movie room adjacent to washers and dryers. With an eye always on the pumps outside, even Brame knows the gas tax isn't going to cut it when it comes to maintaining and refurbishing the state's highways, I-95 included. The rise of electric vehicles and transportation technologies, coupled with the inevitable advent of energy-efficient autonomous vehicles, is one reason why the state's gas tax needs a makeover. The gas tax, which funds 54% of the state's overall transportation resources, brought in $2 billion for fiscal year 2019. But state officials don't expect the number to keep rising, raising concerns about how the cash-strapped NCDOT will pay for improvements going forward. But the list of possible solutions has Brame and the truckers he talks to worried about where the money will come from next. Everybody understands that the gas tax is unsustainable as a sole source of funding, Brame says. They know there's going to be more tools in the toolbox, but whatever happens, it needs to be on a federal level. North Carolina has the fifth highest diesel fuel tax already, the seventh highest gas tax. And it's killed my business, he says, pointing to the larger cluster of truck stops at the Virginia and South Carolina border where gas taxes are lower. North Carolina charges about 36 cents for each gallon of motor fuel sold. 71% of those revenues go toward the highway fund, where they support 65% of maintenance operations, and 29% to the highway trust fund, where they support 39% of capital needs. But in Virginia, for example, the tax is far lower at about 20 cents for diesel. In South Carolina, it's about 23 cents per gallon for gas. The borders are packed with truck stops because nobody wants to be in North Carolina, Brame says. If North Carolina had different tax policy, there might be a lot more competition in the state, but our business would be so much better. North Carolina Transportation Secretary Jim Trogdon says he's heard it before. Under his tenure, he's even formed a task force, NC First, specifically looking at the problem, which he says isn't about funding infrastructure. It's about economic development, Trogdon says. We want to be competitive, he says, and it's not just with those surrounding states. This is a global economy. It's even more important to say, how can we help our industries move freight, be more competitive, create jobs? But maintaining and updating the state's massive highway system takes money. The gas tax isn't cutting it, and time is running out. We need a good roadmap within the next year or two, Trogdon says, pointing to estimates that have motor fuels consumption declining between 2021 and 2025, with the drop accelerating more swiftly over the following 5 years. Whatever the bad outcome is, we want a strategy to handle it before it happens. Problems getting bigger. North Carolina, known as the Good Road State since the 1920s, is at a critical juncture, with more people moving in than ever before, bringing with them transportation challenges. We have a complex multimodal transportation system, plus a fast-growing population that's intersecting, Mark Finlayson, chairman of NCGO, said at the January North Carolina Transportation Summit in Raleigh. As we look to the future, we see a world increasingly shaped by electrification, automation, ride-sharing, and other transportation disruptors. Not only must we plan for those changes, but also plan for the financing of the changes of the changing transportation of tomorrow. And the gas tax is not going to cut it, officials and experts agree. Joe Coletti, a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation, says the point of the gas tax was a user fee. Vehicles cause wear on roads because of their weight and what they drive, he says. You have a car, you have a truck that weighs a certain amount, you drive a certain distance. The fuel economy is largely tied to the size of the vehicle. You buy gas based on how many miles you drive. But as automotive technology has advanced, the math problem has gotten more complex and the gas tax hasn't really changed, Coletti says. Numbers from an Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy Analysis of data from the Federal Highway Administration show that in the year 2000, average vehicles got 20 miles per gallon. On a 15-gallon tank, that meant traveling 300 miles before refueling and paying the gas tax. Fast forward to 2016, however, and the average rose to 22 miles per gallon, meaning that same car could go 330 miles before refueling, and fuel efficiency increases every year. Add in the emergence of electric vehicles, and drivers are taking less trips to the pump, meaning less gas tax pouring into state coffers. But increased fuel efficiency and electric vehicles aren't the only factors putting pressure on the gas tax. In 2016, construction costs came out 66.6% higher than in 2000, according to ITEP. That means a $5 million road project in 2000 cost $8.3 million in 2016. With less gas tax dollars to spend, it's a strain on resources. And a rise in urban density has cut commutes, meaning less miles on vehicles. But as noted by Patrick Mihue of the North Carolina Justice Center, the economics are disproportionate. Even before we started getting into electrification of vehicles, the gas tax was already a pretty profoundly regressive tax that called on low-income North Carolinians to pay a much larger share of their income than folks that are better off, McHugh says. With the older, less energy-efficient vehicles being driven by lower-income individuals, it's putting a disproportionate tax burden on that population. As we move into electrification and hybrids, we know who it is who can afford those fancy new cars, and it's not the low-income North Carolinians, he says. According to a recent Brookings report, commute distances are also rising for minorities and low-income individuals. As poor and minority residents shifted toward suburbs in the 2000s, their proximity to jobs fell more than for non-poor and white residents, a Brookings report claims. Job centers are moving farther and farther away from low-income communities, McHugh adds. Not only are folks at the lower end of the income bracket being forced to pay more for the gas tax, they're also having to travel farther to get to and from work. Need for solutions. Trogdon's NC First Task Force has been tasked with finding real solutions, but Trogdon says its discussions carry variables, as it's unclear what transportation will even look like, even 10 years out. What if we have more connected autonomous vehicles, he theorizes. Will we need as much capacity? Right now, for example, highway facilities typically are built to handle 2,000 cars per hour per lane. But Trogdon says that's because traditionally posted speeds must have spacing between vehicles to the tune of 100 to 175 feet for safety purposes. But if they're connected, that following distance may be 1 foot, he says, which means then you can squeeze more vehicles into the same capacity. At the same time, during discussions at the recent North Carolina Transportation Summit, keynote speaker and author Tony Seba predicted that in the future, transportation costs would be reduced as less people own vehicles. Instead of it costing 50 cents a mile using your own vehicle, it would cost 10 cents because you wouldn't own it, you'd be paying for its use. Add in the promise of autonomous vehicles, which could bring populations not currently driving into the mix, such as the elderly population and young people, and there could be an increase in miles traveled, Trogdon says. The truth is probably in the middle of all that, he says, and it's hard to plan on probably. My guess is we would want a plan that says we don't know if we're going to be moving to fully autonomous vehicle automation by 2030, as Tony Seba predicted, but what we'll want to do is have a plan ready that when these things start to happen, we'll know what needs to be turned on, Trogdon says. NC First, which includes thinkers such as Martin Marietta CEO Ward Nye and former Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarlane, has to wade through all those variables to come up with a report. A final action report is expected early next year so Trogdon can present it to the North Carolina General Assembly before the long session. 2019 was a year of ideas, he says. 2020 will be a year of analysis. And if all goes as Trogdon hopes, 2021 could be a year of action. New version of user tax. The NC First Commission has bandied about multiple options, from adding tolls to fund projects. We continue to maintain that tolling is not the equitable way to do it, Brame says, to adding what's called a mileage fee, but opinion is mixed from experts. Coletti says one solution is a carbon tax based on power input. If you count the power source that generates the electricity, you end up with electric and hybrid vehicles being no more fuel efficient than a standard car, he says. A more popular plan is the vehicle miles traveled tax, charging based on miles traveled, no matter what you drive. But controversy comes in how it would be applied. Coletti notes tracking mileage through a transponder could come at a loss of privacy. Implementation comes at a real challenge, he says. Technology already exists for a framework. North Carolina, for example, has the EasyPass transponder to automatically apply fees for the Triangle Expressway, and it also works for toll roads in places such as Florida and Virginia, something many think would be an essential piece of the equation. If North Carolina moves to a vehicle miles tax and Virginia doesn't, how do you adjust that discrepancy? Coletti asks. It needs to be a federal system, Brame says. You can't just let states do what they want. McHugh worries that just a flat gas mileage tax wouldn't address the problem with lower-income North Carolinians paying more than their wealthier counterparts, but he says it could work if a system were to be constructed where higher-income North Carolinians pay a higher rate. You could certainly develop a system where low-income North Carolinians could be exempted from paying the mileage tax to or from working, now that we would require technology, he says, and that could mean additional privacy issues. There's a huge amount of concern and a lot of pretty justified anxiety, he says. Coletti also worries about the billing process. With the gas tax, it's paid incrementally, while a mileage tax could mean an extra bill. Such a tax could also be a supplement to the gas tax. More toll roads? Tolls are also on the discussion table at NC First, but it's been controversial, records show in past projects. When tolling was posed as a way to fund I-95, outcry ensued. Charlotte is undergoing a similar issue with tolling plans. Coletti thinks that as so many people are moving to North Carolina from already toll-heavy states, the acceptance in the Triangle is easier, but he still doesn't see it as a statewide solution. Tolls for highly traveled roads, they can work really well, he says. We're not going to make every road pay for itself. Complicating the problem is the fact that North Carolina has a lot of mileage. In 1990, 20% of its roads were paved, according to a McKinsey report. Today, it's 77%, and there are more lanes as NCDOT continues to widen roads and add ramps. We have a lot more mileage than has to be paved and maintained, Coletti says. We might be able to take a look at pulling back some of that. He also suggests pushing local governments to maintain roads as opposed to the state. It doesn't make sense to have a road if you can't maintain it, Coletti says. On I-95, there has been recent progress in the form of lane widening and bridge replacements, but it's still an aging highway and one of many across the state in need of attention. Overall, 12% of highways need repair, and 10% of bridges are structurally deficient or in poor condition. Trogdon says the state needs to move quickly before more highways are added to the critical list, and experts concur. I don't think we have any time to waste, says McHugh. I don't think we need a permanent replacement to the gas tax next year, but we need to join the growing list of states actively exploring it so that we can move in a different direction. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Pinehurst says to golfing businesses, move on in. The home of golf is eager to tell others in the golf industry there's plenty of room in Pinehurst, and the region is ready to take on California as an industry hub. This week, leaders from Pinehurst, Southern Pines, and Aberdeen were in Orlando, Florida, for the PGA Merchandise Show to promote the Moore County area to industry executives. The goal is to position the Pinehurst area as a business cluster for the golf industry and get golf-related companies to move to the area, similar to what has happened in Carlsbad, California. That city is about 35 minutes from San Diego and is home to Callaway, TaylorMade, and Cobra Puma Golf. Moore County has plenty to offer, but is largely dependent on retirees, tourism, and a strong healthcare sector. Like many resort areas, the region is looking to broaden its economic base and strengthen its year-round business activity. It got a boost last year when Golf Pride, a division of Eaton Corporation, opened its 36,000-square-foot Global Innovation Campus right on Pinehurst No. 8. Pat Corso, the executive director of Partners in Progress, the economic development arm for Moore County, says Golf Pride was the pioneer, and now the area is pushing to bring in more companies in the golf industry. We just think it's time, instead of sitting back, to be proactive, he says. Corso says there are plenty of niche companies that make putters or wedges that might be a great fit for Moore County, which offers an affordable cost of living and strong school systems. We'd be a great location for that kind of thing, he says, adding, California is so expensive. We have such a favorable business climate in North Carolina. Ford Foundation leader speaking on the South at Duke. The president of the multi-billion-dollar Ford Foundation will be coming to Duke University in late January to deliver a lecture for its Sanford School of Public Policy. Darren Walker, who has led the philanthropic entity since 2013, will be delivering the Terry Sanford Distinguished Lecture January 28 in the Penn Pavilion. Walker will discuss moving from inequality to justice in the South, and will then be interviewed by Duke professor Jay Pearson. The New York City-based Ford Foundation was founded in 1936 and operates with a $13 billion endowment with $600 million in annual grant making. Its focus is international social justice philanthropy. The event is free to the public and will also be live streamed. Previous Sanford lectures have been delivered by figures such as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, retired U.S. Army General Stanley McChrystal, former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres, U.S. Representative Adam Schiff, and U.S. Senator Richard Burr. Former North Carolina mill town is on fire with investments. Mayor Daryl Hinnant remembers how catastrophic it was when the mills closed in Kannapolis in 2003 and 4,000 people lost their jobs. Great big guys would be crying, saying, I don't know what to do. I've done nothing but work at the mill, he says. Now the small town half an hour from Charlotte is in the middle of a remarkable renaissance as it follows a plan developed with UNC Chapel Hill's Development Financial Initiative, and its surge is a blueprint for other towns to follow. A big boost came when California billionaire David Murdoch, the former owner of Cannon Mills, founded the North Carolina Research Campus in 2008 at a former mill complex as a way to study the value of healthy diets. But top researchers weren't interested in moving to Kannapolis, so the town has invested heavily in the downtown and opens a swank minor league baseball stadium in April. Now downtown has a brewery, is soon to announce a flagship hotel, and also plans new apartments. The big lesson, Heinen says, is governments have to communicate with the community, letting them know how they were investing the money and why. We're on fire right now. New business, new investment. It's been a whirlwind for the last 2 years, he says. Durham firm makes a move into Pennsylvania market. Durham's Bull City Venture Partners just made its first Pennsylvania investment in Circonis, a machine data intelligence platform intended to handle the massive volume of data seen in global IT infrastructure and Internet of Things deployments. Bull City Venture contributed to the $6.8 million investment alongside Osage Venture Partners, Ben Franklin Technology Partners, and New Spring. Downtown Raleigh finally adds a boutique hotel. Raleigh's downtown hotel scene, so uninspiring in recent decades, has taken a leap forward now that a new boutique hotel has opened. The Longleaf Hotel, a renovation of a rundown Days Inn by Loden Properties, has just opened as throwback to a motor inn from the 1960s. And if you feel like the Longleaf inspires you to pop on some mod clothes and watch Sean Connery and James Bond films, well, perhaps that's the point of a throwback place with a modern twist. The hotel at 300 North Dawson Street features 56 rooms, a cocktail lounge, and plenty of local products, including Slingshot cold brew coffee, Vidari chocolate, and even Carolina kettle chips. It continues a move toward boutique hotels in the area, with Durham featuring the Unscripted, the Durham Hotel, and 21 Museum Hotel. Russ Jones, a partner at Loden Property, says the Longleaf ushers in a new era of hospitality in downtown Raleigh. And finally, fourth generation arrives at Cannon's. Cannon's Clothing has made the leap to the fourth generation. Mary Cannon Jefferson, the great-granddaughter of founder Isaac George Cannon, is now a buyer and sales associate with the well-known local clothing store. The clothier started in Wendell in 1916 before moving to Raleigh's Cameron Village. Jefferson graduated from NC State University and also got a master's degree from a French business school. She'll be involved in the company's buying trips and relationships with vendors, as well as working with customers. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Tech, Startups and Transportation, written by Lauren Onisorge. The first headline, Eli Lilly picks Durham County to manufacture two diabetes treatments. Eli Lilly and Company plans to bring more than 462 jobs to a new Durham County facility. The drug giant picked Durham County for a $474 million investment over competing sites in both Indiana and Pennsylvania. Eli Lilly is planning what's being described as an integrated life sciences manufacturing facility, one that will provide both drug formulation and filing, as well as final packaging of both marketed and late-stage pipeline candidates. Specifically, the project includes manufacturing operations for two diabetes treatments, Trulicity, an injectable approved in 2014, and Tirzepatide, an in-development drug targeted toward those diabetes patients with increased heart disease risk. If the firm meets all its investments and job milestones, it could mean $8.7 million in state incentives, not including an additional $1.2 million in community college training and another $2.6 million being offered by Durham County. Right now, the company, headquartered in Indianapolis, has 135 existing remote workers in North Carolina as part of its sales team. To qualify for incentives, the firm will not have to retain those jobs, as it's been determined that their functions are separate and distinct from the activities proposed at the site of the project, according to a North Carolina Department of Commerce briefing. Hiring will start this year. Lilly employs 33,000 people worldwide, with more than 7,700 employees in research and development alone. The project was disclosed at a specially called meeting of the Economic Investment Committee, part of the NC Department of Commerce, on January 21. Prior to the Eli Lilly deal, the state had incentivized projects for more than 150 jobs in 2020. They include Sara Lee Frozen Bakery, pledged to create 108 jobs and invest $19.8 million in expanding its Edgecombe County Food Manufacturing Center. LL Flex pledged to create 46 new jobs and invest $7.6 million in a facility in Guilford County. And along with this article, there's some numbers to remember. $73,000, the average annual wage of the jobs coming to Eli Lilly and Company's new Durham facility, and $71,700, Durham County's average wage for private sector jobs in 2019. RDU's funding shortfall and possible solutions. Triangle business leaders have posed multiple ideas for helping Raleigh-Durham International Airport respond to budget shortfall that's looming over the airport's expansion plans. RDU Airport Authority CEO Michael Landguth said that by maxing out its bonds, the airport thinks it can pay for the first 10 years of its master plan, but that the speed at which our capital development is required causes me to have some serious concerns about how to pay for that infrastructure long term, he says. And that's where the business community could come in, according to an on-stage presentation at the Regional Transportation Alliance State of Mobility Conference held January 19. RTA formed a task force last year known as the RTA-RDU Airport Infrastructure Development, or AID, Task Force. As RTA noted on stage, to maintain the current levels of service and accommodate growth, the community will need to invest between $3 billion and $4 billion in RDU airport infrastructure over the next two decades. The report notes a likely funding gap for RDU of $1 billion to $2 billion. The task force did not pose potential funding sources, such as increasing carrier landing fees and activating general aviation landing fees. A $2 airport access fee collected through transponders could pay for roadway needs, the report says. It also suggests reallocating local rental car taxes to the airport, implementing premium curb access areas at terminals, lobbying the FAA for accelerated environmental approvals, and increasing the amount of bond financing. And along with that article, there's a section called By the Numbers. 2.2 million. Delta Airlines boarded nearly 2.2 million people at RDU in 2019, an 11.5% increase over 2018. The airline made up 30.8% of RDU's total in-plane market share. 1.6 million. American Airlines boarded nearly 1.6 million people at RDU in 2019, a 7.1% increase over 2018. The airline made up 22.9% of RDU's total in-plane market share. And 1.3 million. Southwest boarded nearly 1.3 million people at RDU in 2019, a 4.9% increase over 2018. The airline made up 18.3% of RDU's total in-plane market share. Auction of assets looms for Organic Transit. Organic Transit, maker of the pedal-powered ELF vehicle, is a step closer to selling its assets, and the vehicle's inventor could be in the mix. The Durham company, which filed for bankruptcy liquidation, could soon be up for auction, according to a motion filed January 13 in connection to that case. The bankruptcy trustee, James Angel, filed a motion for the court to approve the sale of Organic Transit's assets, from its intellectual property rights to the names Organic Transit Incorporated and ELF. Founding investor Rob Cotter is assisting the process. Cotter has pledged to talk to potential buyers about the opportunity, an executive summary of the asset sale confirms. Cotter says he still has a big connection to the sustainable transportation company he built in Durham and that he might be willing to stay on under a new owner. So certainly that's up to the buyer, he says. Certainly my life of coming up with sustainable transportation didn't begin and end with Organic Transit, and I'll continue doing what I'm doing. If they see fit to bring me on board, that would certainly be an option. Fortiv Unip taps Raleigh for new headquarters. New information has been disclosed about a publicly traded company that's tapped the Triangle for a new headquarters operation. Fortiv Corporation, a diversified industrial conglomerate based in Washington State, announced the new company unit would be called Vontier Corporation and will be headquartered in Raleigh. The new company will employ 8,400 people worldwide. Vontier will be led by Mark Morelli. The name of Vontier comes from a combination of via, meaning a road or a way, and frontier, an expression of exploration and the pursuit of further progress, Morelli stated. And now we turn to the page written by Caleb Harshberger on real estate. The first headline, mixed-use apartment community headed to Durham. A Chapel Hill developer is ready to start work on a new mixed-use community near Research Triangle Park. Lee Properties Group is preparing to begin construction on Davis Park East, a mixed-use development in Durham with plans calling for 403 apartments and restaurant and retail space on the southern border of RTP. Site plans feature 7 buildings up to 5 stories on a site bisected by Faulkner Road. It will be situated on 21 acres at 4701 Hobson Road in Durham, on the border of RTP between the Triangle Expressway and Interstate 40. The land for the development is currently vacant. Company principal Matthew Lee says plans for the project have been fully approved and that construction is set to begin shortly. Lee says the development is designed in the new urban style and places an emphasis on walkability and easy access to places to shop and eat. According to the company website, the apartments will be amenity-rich with lifestyle and service providers integrated with the highly walkable community. This will be the newest urban respite for RTP residents to live, work, play. Rental rates for the apartments have yet to be announced, as have commercial tenants. Lee Properties Group is a Chapel Hill-based commercial developer with offices in New York and projects around the country. The company specializes in multifamily and retail development. The company has apartments in Greensboro and Greenville, and it also owns a Golden Corral in Massachusetts, according to its website. Its latest project comes as demand for apartments in the Triangles continues to rise, driving rental rates higher. A recent report from Zillow calculates how the price of rent has increased in the past 10 years for 50 large metropolitan areas in the U.S., with Raleigh being one of the cities where rents are rising the fastest. And in a section called Big Numbers, $6.7 million, The amount the company paid for the land in 2018 and brought on McAdams to determine the most efficient use for the site, and 25,000 square feet, the amount of restaurant and retail space being proposed at Davis Park East. Longtime Raleigh real estate brokers launched commercial development firm. A trio of longtime Raleigh real estate brokers have taken the entrepreneurial plunge into commercial development with the launch of their own firm with offices on Glenwood Avenue. Brokers Chris Norvell, Justin Good, and Scott Humphrey have left their positions at JLL to start their own commercial development firm, Edgewater Ventures. The new company will specialize in the development of office, multifamily, and industrial properties in the Triangle and across the Southeast. Our team has always envisioned a day when we could take on entrepreneurial roles, says Good. Edgewater Ventures gives us that opportunity. It also allows us to capitalize on our vast knowledge of the market, gained from years of experience as advisors, and to be creative in the investment opportunities we pursue. The trio previously worked at JLL and HFF prior to its acquisition. I think we've been kind of searching for our time and our opportunity to do this, says Norvell. For 10 years, we've done extremely well, but there comes a point where the challenge isn't necessarily there anymore, and you're not challenging your intellect like you used to. He says each of them brings a wide variety of skills and specialties to the work, with Norvell experienced in industrial, Humphrey in life sciences, and Good in multifamily. The three have also worked across a variety of sectors in their time as brokers. Upscale townhomes underway in Durham. A longtime Raleigh urban housing developer is bringing 11 upscale townhomes to Durham. Raleigh-based White Oak Properties has begun construction on 11, a new upscale townhome development that also comes with additional flex space rooms designed to serve as a short-term rental unit, accessory dwelling, or anything else the homeowner would like to use it for. These are particularly interesting because they are designed so each unit has an Airbnb unit incorporated in it, White Oak Properties founder Roland Gammon says. According to the 11's website, homeowners must occupy the townhome for at least half the year to use the space for short-term rentals. Townhomes come in 3 or 4 bedroom units with prices ranging from $599,900 to $1.2 million. The homes are situated at 524 North Mangum in downtown Durham. Raleigh starts process for hotel mixed-use project. The city of Raleigh will begin the search for a development team to lead a large-scale project that could bring a new hotel and a mixed-use tower to downtown. On January 21, the Raleigh City Council voted to release a request for interest, or RFI, to solicit developers for the Convention Center Hotel and Downtown Development Project. Plans would involve 2 new structures, a 500-plus room hotel, and a mixed-use Class A office tower to be built on Fayetteville Street. City officials say the structures are needed to meet the growing demands of the Raleigh Convention Center as the region continues to attract industry and attention. The new project would be situated on the surface parking lots on Fayetteville Street in front of the Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts. The mixed-use tower would sit next to Charter Square, with the hotel situated across the street. Home sales round out 2019 with Banner Month. Home sales in the Triangle rounded out 2019 with a banner month in December as the market saw double-digit bumps for multiple indicators. The latest report from real estate appraiser Stacy Anfinson found the Triangle saw a 12% jump in showings in December to go with a 15% leap in pending sales compared to the same period in 2018. The market also saw a 25% increase in closed sales. For all of 2019, sales saw a 6% jump. Anfinson credited much of the added activity to low mortgage rates in conjunction with the booming economy and population growth. The population of Wake County increased 21% during the decade, with similar observed increases in Durham, Orange, and Johnston counties, Anfinson writes. And in a section related to that, growing demand. In the last decade, the demand for homes led to significant price increases as median closed homes rose. The number of annual closings also went from 20,682 to 41,985. And now we turn to On Healthcare and Education, written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. 9-month-old Mooresville startup sold. A contract manufacturing organization that launched last year has already been snatched up in an acquisition. Morrisville-based Tri-Farm Services has been acquired by Alcami Corporation of Durham. Tri-Farm was launched in May by Patrick Walsh and Eric Evans, the former CEO and CFO of Avista Pharma. The new company is specifically focused on cutting-edge capabilities and mostly targets the injectable market and evolving therapies, such as gene therapy, which require more expensive equipment and higher degrees of certification. Alcami Corporation says it was attracted to Tri-Farm because of its capabilities and existing technology. Tri-Farm represents a compelling opportunity for Alcami to capitalize on building an industry-leading position in attractive and growing end markets as pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical companies increasingly rely on contract development and manufacturing organizations to manage highly technical, sterile fill-finish operations. Alcami Chairman Harry Kramer said in a statement, "I look forward to working closely with the Alcami and Tri-Farm teams to ensure sustained growth in sterile fill finish for Alcami," he says. The exact financial details of the acquisition were not disclosed. As part of the transaction, the former majority owner of Tri-Farm, Ampersand Capital Partners, rolled a portion of its Tri-Farm ownership interest into an ownership interest in Alcami. Walsh will remain CEO of the company until at least the end of 2020. He says they did not originally foresee an exit this soon, calling it a record turnaround. "It wasn't actually the original intention to sell the company in such a short time," he says, "but there's been such a demand to the business that we looked at different considerations to see how we wanted to grow over the long haul and decided that an acquisition would be a good option for our team and our investors." Eli Lilly, bigger U.S. footprint, incentives played important role. The Triangle's budding life sciences industry and robust educational pipeline have helped to lure hundreds of new jobs to North Carolina, but what seems to have swayed global drug giant Eli Lilly to expand in Durham is economics. On January 21, Eli Lilly announced it had picked the Durham County for a $474 million investment to construct a new manufacturing facility that will bring more than 462 jobs to the region. The new jobs come with average annual wages of about $73,000. When asked why the company chose Durham, Eli Lilly's president of manufacturing, Miles O'Neill, says there was probably a few reasons, but the decision initially came down to a global consideration. "We're a global manufacturing company, and when we looked at our global manufacturing presence, we thought that additional presence in the U.S. was really important," he says. "It represents our biggest and most important markets, so a strong presence here in the U.S. was critical." He says in addition to access to markets, the decision to invest in the U.S. was impacted by the tax reforms that were executed recently as well. And after conducting a nationwide search, the company was again swayed by tax incentives. According to state records, if the company meets all its investment and job milestones, it could mean $8.7 million in state incentives, not including an additional $1.2 million in community college training and another $2.6 million being offered by Durham County. "We did narrow it down to North Carolina because it did offer us a lot of incentives," O'Neill says. "The partnership with the government here has been very good. It's a strong area rich in science and technology. The local government is very interested in attracting top industries to this area. We were impressed." Redhill discontinues promoting a pair of drugs. Redhill Biopharma is discontinuing sale of two drugs to focus on launching commercial operations for its lead candidates. Redhill, an Israel-based company that calls Raleigh home to its U.S. headquarters, has announced it is ending its co-promotion and commercialization agreements for Donatel and Interagam. The company has been promoting both drugs since the middle of 2017 through agreements with Entera Health and Advanz Pharma Corporation, respectively. Company officials say the decision comes as a housekeeping measure ahead of its commercial rollout of its newly approved drug, Talicia, which Redhill plans to launch this quarter. Talicia is a treatment for Helicobacter pylori infection, a bacteria that can cause ulcers. It was approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in November, following a year of anticipation and preparation of Redhill as it built up its Raleigh team. Heat closes $7 million secondary fund offering. Heat Biologics kicked off the new year with a public offering to finance its cancer therapeutics, bringing in $7 million. The Morrisville-based drug maker first filed its offering prospectus with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission earlier this month, estimating its net proceeds would be about $6.9 million. Closing its offering on January 21, the company reportedly brought in the $7 million haul from the sale of 20 million shares of its common stock and warrants to purchase another 10 million shares at a combined public price of 35 cents per share. The warrants have an exercise price of 38 cents. The company has also granted the underwriters a 45-day option to purchase up to 3 million more shares. The company has been working for years to develop its immunotherapies designed to activate a patient's immune system against cancer using CD8+ killer T cells. Currently, the company's lead candidate, HS110, is in a Phase 2 trial. And finally, in a section called He Said It, people have long said how much they support this system. Please spare us the platitudes. Just get the budget done. That's from Dr. Bill Roper, UNC System President, at the January meeting of the UNC Board of Governors, admonishing state political leaders to not make this system collateral damage in this political standoff. And now we turn to Dathan Kazakh's page on restaurants and retail. Raleigh Fusion Restaurant offers new pairing dining experience. Tom Cuomo, the chef and owner of Papa Shogun, always wanted to work beside James Beard winner Wiley Dufresne at his WD50 restaurant in Manhattan. So after studying at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York, he became a prep cook at WD50. Cuomo learned under Dufresne and now uses those skills at his downtown Raleigh restaurant. The restaurant recently changed its format, giving its patients a prefix seven-course meal that highlights the fusion of Italian and Japanese. What did you learn at WD50? I learned that you can put out Michelin star-rated food while still having a great time doing it, and that food doesn't have to be so serious. I learned that fusion as a cuisine is probably the most American food out there because we are the great melting pot. What is more American than unifying seemingly disparate cuisine into something that retains aspects of the originals but is entirely unique at the same time? Tell us a little bit about the new seven-course offering. This style was what we had planned on opening with, but we were unsure about introducing an entirely new cuisine in this fashion. Now, a year in, we've gotten great critical reviews and popular acceptance. We thought that it was a great time to do what we originally set out to do, which was not just provide some of the most unique food in the area, but also provide what we think is the best dining experience around. Through our food, service, and wine curation, we think we're providing guests with one of the best. This is why we want people to join us for the hour and a half it takes. New brews, a birthday, and a surprise closing. Asheville's Burial Beer, which opened a satellite taproom in Raleigh last year, will celebrate its one-year anniversary of the exhibit with a can and bottle release in January 24. The brewery, owned by Doug and Jessica Reiser, will offer an afternoon that will include the tapping of Skillet Donut Stout, along with three variants, Magnum Pours, and a birthday cake from Anisette Sweet Shop. In a Facebook post, January 17, Bryce's Brewing Company of Raleigh said it will close January 25. The brewery had recently announced plans for a big anniversary party and different packaging options throughout 2020. We always started our focus with great beer and great people serving it, the post said. We had some issues with beer quality and staffing early on and tried to overcome those misjudgments, and then our owner, Chris Bankston, came down with cancer. The brewery opened in 2017. Raleigh Coffee Roasters, Pine State Coffee, were on hand at the third annual Raleigh Roasts event at the City of Raleigh Museum on January 18. At the event, an employee mentioned to be on the lookout for their collaboration with Raleigh's Crank Arm Brewing Company. The brewery's Motivator Stout, which contains local chocolate and coffee, will be featuring the beans from Pine State for a full-bodied stout beer. Durham Brewery expands to Raleigh. Fans of Durham's Barrel Culture Brewing and Blending will be thrilled to hear the brewery, known for its Summer Jam Sour series, will be opening a new taproom in North Raleigh by March. Barrel Culture will reside between anchor tenants Cut and Gather and Town Hall Burger and Beer. Expansion has always been in the plans for Barrel Culture, co-owner Caroline Barbie says. With this new location, we'll be able to reach a wider audience in North Raleigh. She says plans have moved quickly, with local furniture artists working on the tables and training of the employees coming in the next few weeks. The tap room will feature up to 14 taps, serving up many of its wild and sour ales and IPAs, such as All About How, a hazy-styled IPA. And for those who enjoy Barrel Culture's beer slushies, such as the Imperial Snickers Melt, Barbie says they're bringing the slushy machine to the new tap room. The brewery will also bring its packaged beer, so guests can take beers to go. And the tap room will also carry all the special beer releases, so Raleigh residents no longer have to drive to Durham. And along with that article, there's a big number listed, 2,000, the square footage of Barrel Culture's new tap room that will open in the Wakefield District. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline on his column, More Fees, Taxes, Not Ultimate Answer to Our Mobility Issues. If a task force comes up with a solution that calls for more fees and taxes to solve problems, the task force did not work hard enough. That's exactly what I extracted from the report released by the Regional Transportation Alliance's RDU Airport Infrastructure Development Task Force. The goal of the task force was to come up with solutions to push our airport through the impending funding crisis that could soon hamper the airport's ability to expand and be efficient. Recently, the group recommended some solutions that, among other things, include increasing bond funding, reallocating rental car taxes, imposing $2 airport access fee, activating general aviation fees, and increasing carrier landing fees. What's the common thread in these recommendations? No need to answer that. There's little doubt Raleigh-Durham International Airport Authority CEO Michael Landguth is on the right runway to make this airport into a world-class transportation hub, and he needs help from the state, users, and service providers to get there. In 2019, RDU moved 14.2 million passengers. In 2013, that number was about 10 million. Landguth started his job in 2011. But fees and user tax cannot be the answer to everything. North Carolinians and folks living in the Triangle have other needs. For example, our in-depth story this week on how the possible gas tax drought could create havoc on our roads. What should the solution be? Just raise the gas tax so people who can't afford to buy fuel-efficient cars, autonomous vehicles, and electric cars wind up paying most of the tax increase because they drive a Chevy Malibu? In RDU's own words, the airport can cover about $2 billion in capital needs through 2029, but it believes there will be a funding gap of about $1 billion to $2 billion in the next 15 to 30 years. If you need to cover the shortfall, you need to start with the service providers first. Delta, United, American, and discount carriers such as Spirit, Frontier, and Allegiant have benefited tremendously in the past decade as RDU became an economic powerhouse, thanks in part to our universities and young and skilled workforce, but perhaps most importantly, because it's a low-tax place to do business. Airlines profited more than $5 billion in baggage fees alone last year. They have consolidated in a deregulated environment, rewritten labor contracts, and cut capacity. Delta alone generated $4.2 billion in free cash flow in 2019 and returned $3 billion to investors in the form of buybacks and dividends. Many other carriers had similar returns last year. I have no problems with companies flourishing, but I do have a problem with companies and entities flourishing purely on the backs of its customers through taxes and fees and not innovation and operational efficiency. So yes, asking the air carriers who fly in and out of RDU to pay more in landing fees or some form of property tax is an additional fee or tax, but that needs to be the first trigger point before asking local flyers to up the ante. These are rough issues with no easy answers, but to prioritize the action items, one must decide on a target, and that starts with the airlines, not passengers, using RDU, at least not yet. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to some general news stories. Carey firm files to sell shares to public, written by Sugata Mukherjee. A Quiet Carry real estate brokerage firm with about $1 million in cash and more than $78 million in revenue may soon reach out to the public to sell part of the company. Fathom Realty, started by Josh Harley, a Dallas businessman and a former U.S. Marine, wants to sell about $10 million to $12 million of stock to the public to grow its real estate brokerage business. Harley moved his company to Cary in recent years and now works with prominent Triangle serial tech entrepreneur Marco Fregella to run the technical side of the business. Fregenal started or was involved in several Triangle companies such as How Stuff Works, Evo App, and Carpio Solutions. In filings with federal regulators, Fathom notes through its cloud-based system, it is changing the way residential real estate brokers earn commission after they complete a sale of the house. Traditionally, a real estate broker receives about 3% of the purchase or sale price of a house. Without splitting or taking any percentage of that 3%, Fathom charges $450 in transaction fees for the first 12 homes sold by the agent. After that, the transaction fee drops to $99 for the rest of the anniversary year. All agents are classified as independent contractors. Started 9 years ago, Fathom has now grown to 22 states with sales of more than $78 million through 9 months in 2019 on real estate transactions of $3 billion plus. As of September, the company states it has 3,629 agents and has been adding about 100 new agents every month. Currently, about 90% of the company is owned by three individuals: founder Harley, 50.7%, president and CFO Fregenal, 15%, and Glenn Sampson, 23.7%. Sampson retained the ownership after merging his business with Fathom a couple of years ago. The new offering primarily will be new shares. Despite the rapid growth, Fathom's financials show it is not making any money yet. It lost about $2.7 million in 2019 and about $1.66 million in 2018. Big Blue and Red Hat are truly better together. 6 months after IBM's $34 billion buy of Red Hat, the Raleigh-based open-source software firm is growing underneath its new parent. IBM reported that Red Hat's revenue was up 24% in its just-announced fourth quarter, eclipsing $1 billion in a quarter for the first time. We've spent a lot to invest and modernize our software portfolio to play out the synergistic value of IBM plus Red Hat, and I think we're seeing good momentum and implementation, says Jim Cavanaugh, Chief Financial Officer of IBM. IBM is proving it can leverage its experience to close more Red Hat deals, he says. More than clients are using Red Hat and IBM Container Solutions, Cavanaugh says. The company doubled the number of Red Hat large deals in the latest quarter, with 21 customers signing on to deals greater than $10 million, he adds. You can see we are truly better together, Cavanaugh says. And that was written by Lauren Onersorge. And now we turn to the executive voice, focusing on Johnny Chappell. And the headline is, "He Now Makes Headlines in the World of Real Estate," written by Caleb Harshberger. After spending more than a decade building a career in television news across North Carolina, Johnny Chappell plunged into the world of real estate in 2006. He has since carved out a growing niche in residential and multifamily brokerage and development in the Triangle. Starting out 2 years before the recession meant some challenges, but Chappell steadily built his business and in 2015 launched his own firm, Chappell Residential. 5 years later, the company has grown to include more than a dozen employees and tens of millions in sales closed per year, working with developers around the country and in the region as it reached $1.9 million in revenue. How did you come to Raleigh? I've never been far from Raleigh. I'm originally from Nashville in eastern North Carolina. I graduated from UNC Chapel Hill in 1999 and spent time in Wilmington in South Carolina after college. I transitioned from a career in broadcast news to real estate in 2006. I came back to Raleigh in 2008, a little beat up by the recession, and began rebuilding my real estate business while also going back to work in TV news. I needed the steady income and was lucky to have a chance to put in a ton of hours doing two things I really enjoyed. When did you start your real estate business? I jumped into real estate in 2006 and started Chappell Residential in 2015. I spent my first several years learning, working with large and small firms, making lots of mistakes, realizing my strengths, and figuring out that I wanted to run my own business. Around 2011, I started working with builders and learning how real estate development worked. That experience became part of our firm's foundation. How has it changed over the years? We've been fortunate to grow with our market and with our clients. Chapel has evolved from an army of one to a really talented and fun group of professionals. The volume of business and associated challenges have changed, but our core beliefs have not. We know more, we do more, we care more. How do you differentiate yourself from other firms? We're a boutique, but we do big things. We're progressive in our approach. We want our clients to experience real estate differently. We specialize in working with builders and developers, and we're involved in every step of creating a community from a raw piece of land. We also serve folks who want to buy their first home or sell their fourth. We believe each client deserves a high-touch, tailored experience. How do you see your clients' needs changing? Our clients are smart. They expect us to be responsive, informed, and creative. We launched a full-service marketing division in 2019, an investment which is focused on enhancing each client's experience. How is the industry changing? It's moving faster and consumers have more choices. Disruptions to the industry norm will be relentless over the next decade, which should be welcomed as they will push us to be better. What do you need to be successful in this line of work? You must be responsive. What is the project you're most proud of? I'm really not proud of projects. I'm proud of people. Projects come and go. When you have good people who work hard, you want to work even harder to make sure they are supported and successful. What is the best advice you've received? March to the beat of your own drum, from my mom, on a birthday card at just the right time. What books are on your nightstand? Right now, Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. And in an associated box, a closer look, name, Johnny Chapel, age 42, education, BA, UNC Chapel Hill, communications, family, husband, Ryan Smith, number of employees, 14, first job out of college, weekend sports anchor, WWAY, in Wilmington. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, turning to the Business Survey Pulse, the polling, the question: are you satisfied with the reappraisal of your Wake County home for tax purposes? There are 144 responses. Yes, 52%. No, 40%. And 8%, I don't own a home in Wake County. And to take the weekly surveys, you can go to trianglebusinessjournal.com/pulse to take other surveys. And as we only have seconds left, we're going to go ahead and stop there because we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.